Today's topic is the Jewish attitude towards immigration, asylum seekers, and refugees. So, David Letterman, who's a comedian in the United States, once said that there are about 12 million illegal immigrants in America. But he said, but if you would ask the Native Americans, they would put the number more like at 300 million. Since I'm mentioning late night comedians, so my favorite is Jay Leno. And he once said, President Bush is down in Mexico right now. But I don't think that President Bush gets it. As soon as he stepped off Air Force One, he looked around and he said, wow, you got a big problem with Mexican immigrants down here too. Jay Leno. So of course, bridges between nations and borders between nations are a constant discussion in the zeitgeist. People are discussing it in the States, definitely. It is obviously very much here in the news in Australia. There seems to be a disagreement between the government and the High Court in Australia as to what is appropriate, how to deal with refugees and asylum seekers in an appropriate manner. It seems to be a very hot political topic, not only in Australia, but in Europe, in the States, as I said before, and in many hotspots in the world. The question is, what place does religion have, or what right does religion have to comment on this? And I think that, first of all, as a practicing observant Jew, I filter, as do you know, everybody filters the world through their paradigms that they've developed over their lifetime, and my paradigm happens to be that of an observant Jew, and therefore I filter everything through the prism of the Torah to as I'm formulating my opinions on something. So that I think that, you know, the difference between Judaism, which I've always said is a way of life, as opposed to a religion, is that as a way of life, Judaism encompasses everything. It's very comprehensive. And certainly something as contentious as this and as important as immigration, etc., is something that Judaism would does have something to say on it. But it's actually a topic that has made people who you wouldn't expect to evoke religion in discussing this topic. So one of the people who probably distances herself from religion more than most is Hillary Clinton in the States. And there was a bill once, she was a senator, and there was a bill that was going to crack down on people who smuggle illegal immigrants from Mexico into the United States. And she said that it was against scripture in her reading and understanding of the scriptures. And it would actually criminalize their religious leader, the Good Samaritan, and their religious leader as well. So, and she, you know, she mentioned his name. So there you have a person, a senator, who tries to separate state and religion in a country that's a very big issue. And yet when it comes to immigration, she evokes religion, and she is not unique in that respect. All right, so what does the Torah say about religion, about immigration? What does religion have to say about immigration? Well, let's back up a little bit. And first of all, we know that Avraham, Yitzchak, Yosef, Abram, Avraham, Yaakov, and Yosef, Abram, Jacob, and Joseph were all foreigners in Pharaoh's land. They were all in Egypt. They were all immigrants at one point or another. Our entire nation, the Jewish people, as the Torah describes at great length, were foreigners in an alien land, i.e. Egypt, and they were compelled to live there as immigrants under Pharaoh's rule. And in many, many cases, the Torah reminds us that we are to treat the ger, the stranger, the ger toshav, the stranger in our midst, the immigrant, if you will, with extra compassion and extra care, because they are people who have given up their structures, support structures, etc., to come and live amongst you in a foreign land. If they're your immigrants, then you are the host to these foreign immigrants, and they need to be looked after. And the Torah is full of that discussion. So if you want Vayikra, in Vayikra it says, if your brother becomes impoverished and his means falter and he's close by you, he's in your proximity, the Torah says you shall strengthen him, stranger or settler ger toshav, so that he can live with you. So in other words, if he falters financially in some way, you have to provide him with the welfare that he needs in order to look after him. The Torah also says, if a stranger lives in your land, you're not allowed to harm him. So obviously you're not allowed to harm anybody, but there's an extra special commandment that's added, that you've got to be super sensitive to certain subclasses of people because they don't have the regular family structures and communities, etc., that we might enjoy, and therefore you have to look after these people. And many people evoke these scriptural passages, these psukim from the Torah, in defense of one of the two extreme views that you could possibly have on immigration. Again, the two extreme views would be seal your borders shut, expel anybody who's illegal, become isolationist, a cocoon, don't let anyone in. The opposite extreme at the other end of the spectrum is open your borders without restriction and let anybody in. And of course, most governments negotiate something in the middle of those two extremes. But it would seem from a literal reading of those verses that I just quoted that the Torah would advocate for the extreme of open up your borders without restriction, let everyone in. If they need certain welfare and support, you must make sure that that you provide it for them. However, one has to be very careful. The Torah is not Shakespeare. I often notice that people will take beautiful quotes from Shakespeare, powerful quotations from Shakespeare, to bolster their speeches, to make their points when they're writing essays. And Shakespeare is probably one of the most quoted people in the English language. And yet, nobody knows or even cares what Shakespeare's opinion is on it. Like, you, let's say Shakespeare personally had a personal political opinion, let's say on immigration, where he would say, you know, I don't believe in immigration, you shouldn't allow any immigrants, any foreigners into our country. Let's say that would be Shakespeare's opinion. But you could find a quote that seems to support the other extreme. And that's fine. People do that all the time with Shakespeare. They don't care what Shakespeare really meant. But when it comes to the Torah, you can't say, I don't care what the author meant. And what you can't cherry pick certain quotations. You have to look at it in, as it was always meant to be studied, in a broader context, and not just treat the Torah like Shakespeare. So let's try and look at it in a broader context. And there are a few stops along the way. The first is the very notion of a nation or a national identity. Now, what would you think the Torah would consider on that score? Is that a positive thing? Is it a negative thing? Is patriotism and isolationism and national, national
identity,
are these, according to the Torah, would you think they are to be encouraged or discouraged? Do they provide more benefit to mankind or more harm? The notion of a nation.
I think it depends. Because if you're enlightened to the other nations and we're doing what we're supposed to do, then it's a good thing.
To retain a national identity?
Yeah.
Is a good thing. I agree. And I think that the Torah would say the same. But even there's a prophecy, Yeshayahu, prophet Isaiah, gives a prophecy that even in the perfect world, which is the Messianic era, where everything is as it should be, there will still be an Egypt and an Assyria and a Jewish nation. And yes, the Egyptians will go to the Assyrians and the Assyrians will travel to the Egyptians, says Isaiah, and everybody will be friendly and everything. But then at the end of the day, after they've done their business and they've interacted, everyone goes back to their thing. So it's not like you become a European-style mixed humanity, you know, European Union-style mixed humanity. That is not the ideal of the Torah. The Torah says even in a perfect world, when the world becomes perfect, there will still be independent national identities. There's nothing wrong with that. The Torah encourages it in many, many places. So that's the first thing. The first thing we have to realize in the context of the Torah, that the Torah is very big into separating. Even within the Jewish people, there were 12 independent separate tribes, and there was questions about intermarriage between tribes, and even within Jewry today, there's a Kohen, a Levi, in Israel, there's different statuses, and there's different responsibilities and rights that come to these different statuses. When we eat kosher food, we're actually discriminating against certain animals, not because a horse is bad or did anything evil necessarily, but because God is teaching us, amongst other things, through that mitzvah, that there is very important value in creating separate identities and in people finding comfort in those separate identities. In the Hasidic world, it's interesting, there was when the Maggid of Mezrich passed away. So the Maggid of Mezrich's teacher was the Baal Shem Tov, and the Baal Shem Tov was the founder of the Hasidic movement. His successor was the Maggid. When the Maggid passed away, many of his students splintered off into separate Hasidic groups, and they say that the Maggid bequeathed certain organs in his body to certain of his students. So his brain he gave to the Alter Rebbe, Reb Shnei Zalman of the Adi, and that's why that is the more cerebral element within the Hasidic movement, which is Chabad. Chabad actually stands for Chochmah, Bina, Das, which are the intellectual faculties of a person. So that's one. And he gave his heart to Reb Levi Yitzchak of Badichev, because the Badichev are known for their very emotional way of serving God, and there's nothing wrong with this. These are different styles of serving God, and everyone will find their comfort zone in that particular style. So the first point is, I think that the Torah would encourage a national identity, unique national identity, and also say that that national identity is a privilege that if you wanted to move over to from one nation to another, there are mechanisms within the Torah for that to happen, but those mechanisms will enforce certain criteria and rules before you'll be allowed to do that. Which brings me to the story of Ruth. We all know the famous story of Ruth, that there was a man, his name was Elimelech, and he had a wife, whose name was Naomi. And at that time, there was a drought, a famine, and things were very, resources were very scarce. But Elimelech was a very wealthy person, and anyone who's ever donated to at least one Jewish charity knows, once you've donated to one, they all after you, they all get your name, and they knock on your door. And of course, in Israel, he felt that he was obliged, because he was so wealthy, and he had the resources to support those impoverished brethren who lived there. But he moved away from Israel, and moved to the Moabite area, to Moab, where people were generally more stingy, and so therefore he felt that he wouldn't have to, he would be able to hold his money, keep his money to himself and not have to give it to other people, because that would be the general feeling in that environment. So off he goes, and his two sons and his wife and himself, and they go and they live in Moab. His two sons take for themselves wives who are not Jewish. They intermarry. One is a woman by the name of Orpah, and the other one is the famous Ruth. Then Elimelech dies, his two sons die, and the two widows, Orpah and Ruth, are left in Moab, and Naomi wants to return to Israel, and Ruth, Orpah goes, she doesn't return with her, but Ruth returns with Naomi. And when they get back to, says those famous passages, those famous verses, where you go, I'll go, your people are my people, where you lodge, I'll lodge, where you are buried, I'll be buried. And with that firm and passionate speech and commitment, she converts to Judaism and follows her Jewish mother-in-law, Naomi, to Israel, and is willing to give up on all of her previous background in order to convert to Judaism. And that's a fascinating story, I think, in the immigration context. If we would take that story and bring it into into contemporary society, it makes a very interesting point. And this is the point, that Ruth was accepted, as opposed to Orpah, into the Jewish people only when she was willing to make a firm commitment. Now, I'll go back to some of those verses before that I quoted from Vayikra, where we spoke about a stranger sojourning in your home. That word in Hebrew is ger toshav, which means a ger is like a stranger, toshav, who dwells in your place. And a ger toshav is not a Jew. That's not a person who converted to Judaism. It's a person who came to live in Israel, but according to the Gemara, there's some argument, Maimonides concludes, that they need to accept upon themselves certain fundamental moral principles of Judaism. And those are the seven Noahide laws, which define their sexual relationships, their the legal system that they bind themselves to, not allowed to steal, got to follow the laws of the land in terms of the courts, etc. Not to be cruel to animals, to believe in God. So these are moral and ethical and religious values that they had to espouse as a precondition for them to become immigrants. And here, I think, is where the crux of the Jewish attitude would lie. Judaism does not recognize immigration quotas. As far as Judaism is concerned, we trust in God, we believe in God, God is infinite, He has infinite resources, the land can absorb no end of worthy immigrants. Immigrants should not be judged ever on racial background, on ethnic background, religious beliefs, or anything. Everybody should be let in, as far as the Torah is concerned, into a land, with one huge difference. And I don't see this being practiced, at least to the level where I would like it to be practiced, anywhere else, but I think that's what the Torah would insist on. And what would the Torah insist on? That as a precondition for citizenship, to gain citizenship, you have to undertake to do certain things. Now, I will mention some possible things that one could enforce on a person before allowing them to become a citizen. It could be something like a point system. If you have these criteria, you get certain points, and then when you hit a certain threshold of points, you would become a citizen of that nation. So, and anybody should be allowed to apply and to begin this process. But the process itself will weed out undesirables, because there is a great fear of letting in anybody into a country, in that you could be importing certain attitudes, criminal activity, etc., that are undesirable to the population that exists in the country. So, as controversial as this might sound, these are some suggestions of what I would see as being prerequisites to becoming a citizen. First and foremost, to learn the language of that country. I think that if people cannot learn the language of the country within a set amount of time, so let's take the Australian model. If people cannot become speak English, Australian, either one of those two languages would be fine. If people cannot speak English in X amount of time, then they would lose their visas to remain in this country. So English should be an absolute prerequisite. Nobody should ever be allowed to integrate into a society if they don't have the fundamental tools to assimilate into that society, which is language. Now, there is an exception. And the exception would be if you... I believe in family reunification as being part of... As being a fundamental part of any immigration policy. So that means if somebody comes into the country and hits all the points and becomes a citizen and then wants to bring in their 80-year-old mother into the country and, you know, she can't speak English, this I understand. There would be certain compassionate exceptions, but these would be exceptions, not the rule. The rule should be you must speak English. I'm reminded of the joke. They used to actually test this in America. As part of citizenship, you had to be able to speak English. And so they used to give immigrants a test. And the last question on the test was construct a sentence using the words pink, green, and yellow. So this Mexican, when it came his turn to answer the question, he said, sure, he wrote like this follows. When the phone goes green, 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 I pink it up and I say yellow. So obviously the first thing is you have to learn English because you cannot assimilate into the culture without that. And that would score you, well, that would be a deal breaker. There could be deal breakers or you score points. The other thing is all immigrants should be required to perform, and I know this is controversial, but I've really thought about it deeply and I don't think that this is totally absurd, as some people have said that it is. And that is that they should have, they should be required, obligated to perform community service, volunteering in soup kitchens on a regular basis, X amount of hours per week. In a soup kitchen, Peace Corps type of work, building homes, let's say for other immigrants, cheap housing for immigrants to be able to live in, maybe helping to process other immigrants and assimilate them, whatever. I mean, there's no shortage of work that needs to be done. And here it would be probably very good to engage different religious organizations, schools and churches, and have them involved, which I think they should be involved in this process anyway. My opinion is always that these kind of grassroots organizations do things more efficiently than government could ever dream of doing them. So, for example, government should make funding available to synagogues, let's talk absolutely practical, to help South African Jews to immigrate to Australia. And the synagogues should have funding which would enable them to hire people to help immigrants with jobs, with finding properties in the area around the synagogue, etc. And this could be government funded, but controlled and administered by the various religious organizations and other non-profit organizations at a grassroots level. Back to my prerequisites. People who live outside of traditional cultural enclaves should score higher points. So that means if you come in, you're a South African Jew and you don't move straight away to Caulfield, you'll get more points than if you do move into Caulfield. The idea is you want people to assimilate into the culture, and that's the whole point behind this. So having them live in ghettos where they are around people who share the same culture as them would seem to defeat it.
There's no synagogues in other places.
So Doncaster.
You
move Doncaster, and then Doncaster will be very happy, that would fulfill the criteria. But again, remember, Jewish people Jewish South Africans tend to share many of the same values as Australians do, and so that would not be. But again, that would not be a deal breaker, but you would score higher points if you're living. You know, I'm thinking there's certain areas in Montreal where I lived for 18 years, which are very predominantly Muslim areas, and there's a lot of anti-Semitism that comes out of those areas, a lot of anti-Western sentiment that comes out of those areas, and a lot of people live and function in those areas in Arabic and don't ever have to learn English or French, which are the languages of Canada, and they don't ever have to, they could just as well be living in Afghanistan or Saudi Arabia because they have not assimilated at all into the, there are people in Britain who are seventh generation on the dole. That means for their great-great-great-grandparents went on to social welfare when they moved to Britain, and they are seventh generation on welfare, consecutive generations, who do not speak one word of English, living in London today. So they are able to benefit from the great social experiment of welfare in London, but do not... are not required in any way to assimilate into the population. And many of the terrorist groups that have been uncovered or have perpetrated violence in England have come from these areas. And this is a hotbed for these places. And so this, you know, by making people live amongst other people in Britain or here in Australia, would give people more points because it would help them. Placing children into state schools would definitely score many points. If a person is married, that should score higher points. You know, and married to the spouse is also the parent of their children. In other words, somebody who's divorced would score lower points, whether they got divorced prior to coming to this country or within this country. Again, as a way of, we identify, and many, many studies identify the family, the nuclear family, as being very important for a healthy, well-balanced societies. It's the building brick of society. So if we identify that as something that's important, then that's what we insist if somebody becomes an immigrant or wants to become a citizen of this country. They have to pay taxes, of course, they have to be involved in various non-profit government organizations, even having them barrack for a footy team, becoming a member of a footy team in Australia may be a possibility to score points. So anything that will help them assimilate into the culture of Australia. And I think that the Torah, you know, anyway, before I get to the Torah, let me quote Benjamin Franklin, who wrote to Britain, and he said, Britain, this is an exact quote, thou art called our mother country. So he's writing a letter from America to Britain in the late 1700s, and he's writing, you call yourself our mother country, he says, but what good mother ever sent thieves and villains to accompany her children, to corrupt some with their infectious vices and murder the rest? I don't know what he would have said about Australia, but anyway, let's put that aside for a moment. In other words, you see that he was very much, I mean, he was a politician, and he wrote extensively against allowing immigrants in who drank, you know, who were alcoholics, who a lot of prohibition-supporting politicians in the United States, including Benjamin Franklin, were also very pro-immigration, high immigration criterion standards. So we'll let in people. This whole idea of, you know, an American kind of a WASP, an American WASPy culture, is something that came way after Benjamin Franklin. It's a much more recent invention. But in those times, the founding fathers of the United States were very pro-immigration, as long as immigrants adhered to these very high moral standards. So if they would drink ever, that would disqualify them to become immigrants of this country. So we have to, it's a careful process. I think a much, you know, better than, you know, Christmas Island, this, that, a much better way of looking at it is say, we let in everybody under these conditions. And you make the conditions as high as you want and as onerous as you want. And all the conditions have to be connected to some kind of moral, ethical thing, to forward the highest values of the society. And I think that is the balanced view that the Torah would want. And although I don't hear this view mentioned very often, I can tell you that I think it would solve the problem. It would probably make people on both sides of this argument upset, but it would ultimately create the kinds of societies that we want and preserve our national character, which is so important, and also make sure that the rule of law is adhered to. And I don't think that is too onerous an ask. So that is my opinion, or what I think the Jewish opinion is on the subject. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, or criticisms.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Obviously, the topic of the lecture is illegal immigration.
Legal?
Illegal. Or just immigration? Because
the topic is immigration.
Immigration, okay. Because the hot topic now is illegal migration. Nobody argue about immigration. Every country has a quote. We have Australia can have a quote, 120,000. They have to collect points. They now the last 5-10 years, they introduce language test all over the world. You go to embassy, you go through this test. That's what we're talking about. We have points. But now the topic, illegal immigration. What to do with illegal migrants who come in without immigration?
There should be no such thing, in my view of the system, there should be no such thing as an illegal immigrant. Because there's only two categories of people. Everybody should be allowed in. Everyone. As long as they fulfill these criteria.
Okay.
No, you either pass or you fail. It's like being pregnant. You either pass or you fail. So if you... So everybody comes in and is well documented and tracked. You go on a process. You embark on the process. Some people will take longer. Some people take less because they can speak English, because they can't. Whatever it is. Till you get those critical threshold of points that will mean that you have assimilated into Australian society. If you fail at any point in time, like you break a law, for example, criminal law, and you are convicted in a court of breaking some criminal law, that is automatic grounds for eviction. That's it. There is no illegal, because why would anybody be illegal? You come here and you are welcomed with open arms. Welcome, this is the system, this is the process, it's clearly defined, it's well explained, it's fair, and it's very difficult. So it's going to be much easier for you to go to Europe, where they don't have this system. Or America, where there is no English requirement anymore to become a citizen of the United States. There are other requirements that are very difficult, so that's why people just do it illegally, because the requirements become, at a certain point, they become impossible. I'm not talking about impossible requirements. I'm talking about moral and ethical assimilation into the culture and the values of that society.
We're talking about next step. We're talking about just how to enter the country first.
Okay, so let's say somebody comes on a boat.
That's question number two.
Let's say somebody comes on a boat.
You can go back 10, 20 years and see that some groups, they haven't been assimilated and they never will. It's another issue.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about who will be allowed to the country.
Then they would never get, if they don't assimilate, they would never get citizenship.
People should be allowed to enter the country by the boats, legally without any...
Let's say somebody comes in illegally by boat. Yes. First of all, most immigrants, illegal and legal, to Australia, vast, vast majority, come by airplane.
I know.
Certainly the legal ones, and even the majority of the illegal ones come by airplane. But let's say somebody comes on a boat, somebody smuggles them in. So they come to Christmas Island. Okay, so now you're on Christmas Island. Christmas Island is a school. It's a school that's going to indoctrinate you into Australian values. The first thing it's going to do is teach you English.
No, the first thing, they're coming without any purpose. We don't know who these people are.
That's fine. We don't care, because I don't want immigration to be based on race or papers or anything.
It's not racist.
If you're a living human being and you walk into the thing, you're a candidate for immigration.
Now, these people, considering they're all coming from the Middle East,
they can come from wherever.
From Iraq or
Afghanistan.
Afghanistan.
Yeah.
We don't know where they are.
That's fine.
They're
don't
Muslim,
care.
The Taliban, yeah.
Perfect. I don't care. Because my process will weed out those that cannot assimilate into the environment. And those that can, I want them. So, they come in. Let's say they have no education or so on. I mean, to administer an ESL test, an English as a second language test, no big deal. You administer that. Those that fail the test, of which I'm sure many would, are immediately, there are schools assigned to them and they start learning. But they're given a certain amount of time. You have 1 year, let's say, to reach a certain level of proficiency. And obviously, I mean, the times and the levels and everything, these need to be obviously worked out. But let's assume that they were. At the 1 year mark, if you're not ready, if you did not do it, we say, we're terribly sorry, but we'll send you to, but we cannot, except you did not go through that criteria. That's it.
I'm not...
And there's nothing wrong with
I'm not to spare my tax money, which I'm paying to the government, to educate all these people who come. Because today it's 2 boats, tomorrow it will be 1,000 boats. Who come here and they can stay here for another year and learn English, free of charge.
You're spending the same tax money and more by not doing this. And I'll tell you why. Because if you spend the tax money to educate them, and then they come and they become productive members of society, and they get a job and they start paying taxes and everything, they be, become your partners in supporting this. And that, as I said, I believe everything comes from Hashem, and He's infinite, and He can give everybody everything that they need. And this country is certainly big enough and wealthy enough to support 1,000 bats. But the problem is, you are paying now a fortune of money. I mean, did you hear about that? What was the cost to keep one family? It's like $1 million or something. They kept this family, and they flew some.
The money is being spent.
The money is being spent. The money is just being misspent. I say it should be directed to, once people have gotten through a kind of a reception area or a holding area, and which they may be for a few months, a year, whatever, and they've passed whatever requirements are there, then they need to be brought into the community. They need to be, and then the government, your tax dollars should be given to synagogues and churches and other non-profit organizations who use money much more efficiently than government does. And these people should have programs, which are, of course, there should be government oversight, but they should have programs that they assimilate and draw these people into their communities and make them become part of their communities. When these people have children and these children go to state schools, which they will go to state schools, and then that will give them more points to become citizens. When their children go to university, if they're still not citizens yet, that would be the clincher. Once a child goes through their entire schooling here in Australia and completes university and gets a job and becomes a productive member of society, that's one less. You've divided the tax burden by another one person. So I don't think that, if you come from a religious or godly viewpoint, as I do, which I admit, not everyone agrees with me, that's fine, but that's my point of view. So I don't have a scarcity mentality. I think there's enough pieces of the pie for everybody. You don't have to focus on only one. But anyway, thank you for your question. Again, if you don't believe that God is big enough to provide all of us what our needs...
Absolutely, God is big enough. People have different view anyway.
I mean, there was an economist, Malthusian economics. There was this economist who said that the world, and by the way, he said this when there were under 1 billion people in the world. There's today over 6 billion. But he said that there's not enough resources in the world to sustain everybody, and so we shouldn't have children, etc. And of course, religion has always said, when you bring a life into this world, most Judeo-Christian religions believe bringing a life into this world is bringing a holy piece of godliness into this world, and doing so is a great and noble endeavor, and God will provide, and He has. We're at 6 billion, and still there is enough food. Whether it's getting to everybody or not, that's a separate issue, which is a very important issue, but there is definitely enough food in the world today, from what we waste in the Western world, etc., to certainly feed 6 billion people. So, and I'm sure that, Malthus did not realize that there would be such advances in technology, which is converted. It's interesting, in 1900, 97% of workers, people who were employed in the United States, worked on farms or food production. 97% of all workers in the United States in 1900 were working on farms. Today, only 3% of all workers in the United States work in the food industry, in producing or delivering food to us. So it's exact opposite. So in 100 years, we went from requiring 97% of our workforce to just keep us all fed, to requiring only 3% of our workforce to keep us all fed. So, God's pretty imaginative, and He'll figure out ways. And certainly, I look at Australia. Australia is a huge country with incredible resources. And I don't think, there's a problem. My problem with immigration is if you let in a criminal element, then they could destroy the very thing that makes this such a beautiful and wonderful country. That is what I'm trying, that my preconditions for immigration are going to eliminate. And it has precedence in the Torah, where if you want to be a Ger Toshav, you had to keep the 7 Noahide laws. And the minute you didn't keep the 7 Noahide laws, you were... executed. It was actually it was a capital offense for a Ger Toshav to live in and violate one of the seven Noahide laws in Israel. So there was no in the land of Israel in those times. So there was no tolerance. This was an absolute thing. But everybody knew what the rules were, and lots of people came to Israel and worked on this in this thing. You know, there's I'll just conclude.
I'll add to your point as well, Alex, in a moment.
I'll just conclude, because I know I've probably gone a little bit over time, but I'll just conclude with an experience that we had with a program in Canada. In Canada, there's something called the Live-In Caregiver Program, which is quite an ingenious program. What it does is it says like this, for families where both parents earn an income, they're both parents work, they are candidates for this program. And what this program is you could bring in an immigrant, and people would mostly, it was primarily, although not exclusively, these immigrants were from the Philippines. And you could bring in an immigrant, sponsor a person to an immigrant to come in. You would be responsible for interviewing that candidate, and when you know the successful candidate that you hire would come into Canada, and they would be required to work for you and for your family for a period of 4 years, I believe, if memory serves me correctly, at which time they would get permanent residency status in Canada. So they were in kind of a holding pattern for those 4 years where they were allowed to work only for you as their employer. If, for whatever reason, you decided that they were not suitable to work in your home then and with your children, then you could obviously release them from your employment, at which time they had 30 days to find alternative employment. Otherwise, their visa would expire and they would be required to leave Canada. And what that program accomplished is, first of all, it has been going for many decades now, a couple of decades. And and the government pays half the person's salary up to a certain maximum amount. So it means that parents who have children can have help in the home. These caregivers are live-in, so they actually live in your home. They help with things like laundry, cleaning, cooking, helping the kids in different ways. And that allows the parents to both go out and work without having to farm the kids off into strangers' places, warehousing, children I used to call it. They could stay in their homes, their familiar environment, with a familiar adult that they have a very close and intimate relationship with. So it was better for the children. The young children were better, more well-adjusted. It was better for the parents, for the economy, because parents went out. And for immigration, it was remarkable, because basically each family would be the perfect filter to make sure that the person, to work that intimately with a family for 4 years. If you were caught, stealing or doing some other dishonest thing or inappropriate thing, the family would not be obliged to keep you. So we became the filters and did the government's job. And as I said, we always do things more efficiently and better than the government could ever dream of doing it. So therefore, we actually did a good job. And hundreds of thousands of former Filipino nationals have become Canadian permanent residents and citizens through this program, and thousands of families have been able to work and be productive members of society whilst raising children in a wonderful way. Fantastic program. That's the kind of innovative thinking that you need to apply to this. And governments are not capable of innovative thinking. So it has to come from the grassroots. It has to come from us. And what better way than to inspire ourselves from the greatest book ever written,
Thank you very much.
Thank you. But adding to the point of